This is BDO in the Boardroom, a podcast by the BDO Center for Corporate Governance for the Board of Directors and those charged with governance. We're joined by your board peers and inspiring leaders to discuss the trending and timeless issues that are impacting today's boardroom agendas. Let's get started.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of BDO in the Boardroom. I'm Amy Rojek, your host and director of BDO's Center for Corporate Governance, and I'm joined today by my guest and friend, Deborah Boggs. And we're going to talk about a few things because most board searches don't fail because someone lacks credentials. They fail because candidates launched with the wrong strategy, the wrong story, and the wrong assumptions about how seats are actually filled. So today we're going to focus on how to avoid the preventable mistakes that delay or derail a person's board journey. So my guest, Deborah, is the CEO of DNS Executive Career Management and works with senior leaders on competitive positioning for board opportunities. And Deborah and I have both had the pleasure of presenting together, and I have found her guidance to be right on the money, along with good stories and good examples of what not to do in order to be your best self in getting a board seat. So I've invited her to share her wisdom with our listeners today. And Deborah, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Amy. I'm really excited to be here.
All right. Well, I think we should start out with where many candidates tend to lose months before even realizing it is in the targeting process. But perhaps before we do that, maybe give us a little sense of your organization and how you all engage with your clients.
Yeah, absolutely. So our firm, DNS Executive Career Management, works with senior leaders, typically C-level and board level for purposes of this conversation, to prepare for, navigate, and land their next big thing. And so for board candidates, we're typically working one-on-one to really target the right board opportunities, get the positioning together, and then the networking and go-to-market strategy that it takes to really land a board seat, understand how to show up strong in the interview process because it is a completely different animal, and really just how to get from board ready to really a seat at the table and what that process looks like.
Great. And so maybe with that as the tipping point for our discussion today, what do you think are the most, I guess, common, targeting mistakes you see, whether it's around industry, company size, ownership structure, geography, and I guess maybe what's your best go-to framework for narrowing to a focused, but maybe realistic target market?
Yeah, so really having a target market or not having a target market is really the biggest mistake I see, and it derails an entire search, and it can add a year or more or be the difference between landing anything or not. And it's really around understanding that you have to have a target market so that you can build a strong value proposition. You can't just say, you know, the things I hear from board candidates all the time when I say, okay, what does the ideal board look like for you? What kind of companies would you like to serve? And the things I hear most often are, oh, I have 30 years of experience in XYZ kinds of companies, but as a CEO, I can really help any company grow. But the problem is any company doesn't care. And we really need to think about how we're differentiating and adding value, because you may be top in your company as CEO or any of the other C-level seats, but in the board market, you're one of many. Like having 25, 30 years of experience in a C-level title are table stakes. And what else are you doing to really stand out? And so it really starts with targeting. And I took a group of board candidates through this yesterday, actually, and it's difficult, but it's really essential to get as narrow as possible. You don't want to cast too wide of a net, because when you cast a wide net, you're diluting your value to the companies that you really are most uniquely equipped to serve. So getting as specific as possible around, I know you mentioned company ownership structure, public companies versus private companies. And then when you dig into startups versus ESOPs versus family owned, have very different challenges in the market, in the way that they operate, in their governance structure. And so we really need to get clear about that, clear about company size. You know, an enterprise company has very different challenges from a governance perspective than, say, a mid-market company that maybe has 1,000 to 5,000 employees. And then getting clear on that industry. Having at least like industries is really helpful if you have a couple, but it's really hard. I talked to a candidate recently who said they're really open to real estate or manufacturing or high tech. Those are all very different industries. So getting as clear as possible, and it's uncomfortable, but it's essential.
It's funny, maybe you've heard this before, but the spray and pray. not a strategy, right?
It's... not a strategy. You're never going to stand out. You're not going to have a compelling leadership narrative. It's just not going to land the way you think it's going to land.
So I guess maybe once I think someone starts thinking along those lines of disciplining their targeting, what's the next place they often stumble, and maybe how they can explain the value proposition to the board? I think a lot of the folks that we work with or we, you know, engage with really are challenged in really narrowing in and being very concise and clear about what their value proposition is as a board member.
I love this because, yes, as a board member is the difference, right? And the way you need to show up in this market as a board candidate are different, especially if you haven't had a seat at the table. And so the framework that I take most candidates through is really, you know, you're going to get clear on that focus. You're going to have a very clear target market. And then the next step is thinking about what are the challenges going on for that target market right now? The biggest challenges from a governance perspective. So, you know, regulatory challenges, market challenges, you know, anything going on in the workforce development, what's going on that is either preventing growth or could be barrier to growth or things like that. And then the next step is how are you uniquely equipped to help solve for those challenges from a governance perspective, from a nose in, fingers out perspective. You're not being brought in to do anything, but you're being brought in to advise the C-suite team. You're being brought in to see around corners, to drive high-level strategy and risk mitigation. And so we need to start with the focus, think about the challenges, and then build out how you're uniquely equipped to solve for those challenges. And then thinking about the skills that are required for a board director. And this is something we do, and I know you know this, we do this in workshops and individually with clients, but the board skills are going to be higher level, right? You're not being brought on to lead product development, right? You're not being brought on to one thing I hear clients talk all the time about is how great they are as a team leader and building teams and putting the right people in the right seats. That's not a value proposition for the boardroom. And then thinking about some of the emerging things that are coming up, you know, AI, cybersecurity. Just read an article that one of the big four put out this morning about how cybersecurity is now something that every person around the board table needs, right? It's not just something that the CIO needs to understand, but it's something everyone needs to understand. So thinking about what's going on in the boardroom now, what value you bring from a perspective and who you're talking to or what really help you put that value proposition together.
Yeah, I think the cybersecurity example is excellent because I think that the conversation has really shifted from financial literacy of all board members, which is table stakes, right? For every board member needs to understand how a company makes and loses money by reading their financial information. But now it's become much more about, do the members of the board really understand the environment that the companies are operating in today? And whether that's the risk brought on by a cyber-related world, and then that's just being exacerbated by the rapid evolution of technology. So what is the literacy of board members in that case? And I do believe that it's no longer about having the expert necessarily on the board, but it's about folks that are on the board being able to understand the risks and opportunities that are being presented to their businesses in real time. That's a big lift for a lot of folks.
You can't just be a narrow functional expert anymore. I know you and I were on a panel recently where someone talked about needing that T-shaped experience, right?
Yep.
You need to go deep in your area of expertise, but you need to bring a literacy around a lot of other areas, financial, AI, cybersecurity, all of these other things. So it's so incredibly important for board directors now.
We get into the argument of generalists versus specialists, and I don't think it's not an either or. It's everyone needs to that T part, the top of the T, where they're really broad and deep in all of the things that a board has to look at, but then they come with their relevant and deeper skill sets that have to align with what is needed by the board, right? Mm-hmm. So, and that's, I think, how some of the search things where I see people kind of waiting, and it's because they're not articulating their ability to work within the boardroom, engage stakeholders, but also bring those special things that either complement or fill gaps in a board that's already there. So And I think one of the points you made earlier that I tend to love is, you know, you kind of arrive, you've had a C-suite role, you kind of think you're all that. just making humor there. But think of that as, you know, my kids were all college athletes, right? But yeah, everyone that arrives at college was the top athletes, you know, wherever their environment was. So you don't have that. You're not that key person that you were in high school. You are now competing very heavily for a spot at the table. And that's how board candidates need to think of it. Everybody was the top of their game coming out of the business world. How do they differentiate themselves from the rest? What do they need
to do? You're competing on a very different level. And if you're not staring eye to eye with that level all the time, you don't realize it. So when you do hit that, it's a reality check that a lot of people make of thinking, well, you know, I'm on these board lists, I'm this, I'm that. I should have tons of board opportunities. And it doesn't always work that way. So one of the biggest mistakes I see a lot of board candidates make is not understanding the timeline for this process. You know, the majority of our clients and people we work with are people that have built amazing careers through their network, getting promoted, getting recruited. They've had really amazing executive careers, but the pathway to the boardroom is opaque. There's no real roadmap to say, if you do this, then you will get that. And that's really frustrating for a lot of people, because I think once they decide they want a board seat, or they keep hearing from people, you would make a really great board director. That's something we hear candidates say all the time. Well, I keep hearing I'd be great. But it takes time. You know, starting a really serious board search, we tell our candidates it's going to take 18 months, 2 years maybe, to land that first board seat, that first paid director role. But it doesn't mean that you may not get tapped on the shoulder for something sooner. But if you're starting a serious search, those are the expectations we want to set, because it's going to take a while. So to give you an example, you know, it's hard when someone, and this happens all the time, reaches out maybe 6 months after they've retired and they've rolled off their executive role, and they call me and say, well, you know, I thought I wanted to spend some time hanging out at home, but really I'm climbing the curtains. My wife's going to kill me. I need to get back out of the house and get back into things. And I want a board seat. That's great, but it's a lot harder now to start that board journey when you no longer have the executive title behind you to get the meetings. And also, you know, it's going to take a while. So you're going to sit on the bench for a little bit. It's a lot easier if we start maybe at least 6 months, a year before retirement, you know, to start that process, to really start building that network, to start building your value proposition, to start telling people you're open to, you know, you have capacity for a board seat, things like that. The other thing is, I had someone call, I spoke to yesterday actually, who said, I want to start my board search because I'd like to roll off into really making board work my full-time focus in 10 years. And I said, okay, we're too early and we can start thinking about what that looks like, but, and maybe getting a board seat or two, but we don't want to fill your time because you're still working full-time for another decade. On the flip side, I've got someone who is a publicly listed chief operating officer who plans to retire in 6 months. Now is the perfect time to start building that network and bench.
Yeah. And I think that's the important thing. I think a lot of people, we've had this discussion, you and I, in the past, but a lot of people shy away from the word networking because that's, I hate doing that. I spend enough time, you know, I don't need to go out, make small talk. But I like to look at it differently. Networking is really about relationship building, and it's about understanding who you already know and how to better cultivate relationships that will help you grow into kind of the next position you're seeking. And that's not to say, you know, you're going out there and just trying to use people to, you know, get something you want. It's building a deeper foundation with folks that you're dealing with daily on how do I do this? How do I give to get? What opportunities, what skill sets, what advice, what whatever can I provide to this person so that in some place in the future, they might be in a position to help me achieve a board role?
Building relationships is so important. And I love that you bring that reframe to the conversation, because we don't mean going into those networking events where everyone's handing out business cards and everyone's looking over your head to see who else is in the room that they should be talking to, right? Like, those are just painful. But the other thing I hear from candidates all the time is, well, I'm networking a ton. I'm having 5 virtual coffees a day and it's not turning into opportunities. And that is not a good use of your time. What you said, and I'd like to push on a little bit, is the idea of strategic networking. Who do you need to know? What rooms do you need to be in? So we have a candidate right now who just joined NACD. And I said, great. In our next session, we're going to dig into what interest groups, what events, what things, who in the organization do you need to be meeting to maximize that membership? Because just being a member isn't the thing. Right. But how are we really going to drive the relationships that you need to have within this organization?
No, exactly. That's critical. One of the things that, you know, kind of comes from this is the concept of how boards really find directors, right? How do you become referable? I think, you know, many candidates overestimate the power of applying and underestimate the importance of being referable. So where do candidates most misunderstand how board seats are filled? You know, search firms versus chair, CEO, investor, and director networks, and what maybe networking mistakes quietly undermine strong candidates.
Let's talk process first. And a couple of mistakes I see that add time to the process is candidates will say, well, you know, I'm ready for a board seat. Can you introduce me to some board recruiters? So yes, there are board level recruiters. Both boutique firms and the large firms have board practices. But board recruiters can really only place been there, done that candidates. You have to have sat at the table as a board director to really be able to be placeable by an executive search firm. It doesn't mean that you don't need relationships in that space for your second, third, fourth board seat, but it's not the first place you want to start. The other thing then people go into, okay, well, where can I apply? What lists can I be on to be found? Things like that. This is not a passive process. This needs to be an active search process because most seats at private companies are filled through the current board directors and executives and or investors network. They're not typically working with a search firm. They're not typically placing these ads anywhere for jobs to apply for. And most first-time board candidates are going to get a private company board seat first. Very rarely do you move straight from your career into a public board seat. We've only ever had one client do that, but she was chief accounting officer for a Fortune 5. So, you know, that's different. Most people are going to start at the private company level. And what I typically say is the better entree into board paid director role with a fiduciary responsibility, you know, as an actual governance is an advisor role. And it's usually a decision made with the founder or CEO. They may have an advisory board formally. It may just be a one-to-one decision, but that's a better entry than maybe say doing what I see a lot of women try to do is a ton of time in nonprofit boards waiting to be board ready, waiting to have the qualifications, because that doesn't really land in the board seat either. So it's really knowing and having relationships with the people that are going to make those referrals, right? That are going to say, hey, you should meet so-and-so. To your point about being referable, it's having a very clear ask. And as an example of that, I had a client that actually I know you know well too, and she had been a public company board director and had rolled off that board and could not find another board seat. And she couldn't figure out why. She's, I've sat at, you know, on a public company board. I can't understand why I can't get another board seat. And we looked and she has an incredible background, but it's all over the place. Her background is varied as I've ever seen anyone's. And she was trying to be all of those things and telling people, well, I could do this or I could do that, or I've really had experience in that. And I speak all of these languages. And people didn't know what value she brought because there was too much going on. And so we really narrowed her focus into just one of her areas of expertise to say, when you're networking with people, here is the story you're going to tell. Because if it's not easy, people can't repeat it, right? And making it really short. And that was the turning point for her to get her board journey back on track and land additional seats after that.
Yeah, no, I think that's incredibly astute.
People send me, you know, messages in LinkedIn all the time. People often mistake me for a recruiter. And so I'll get these messages and it's either one of two things. It's, I'm open to a new opportunity. Here's my resume. Let me know if anything aligns with what you're placing for. And no one is going to do that work for you. No right. one is going to decide what you'd be best fit for. You need to tell them. We need to make it easy for our network to understand what we want. Or I open the message in LinkedIn. I'm on my phone and I'm scrolling through the history of the universe of their career starting in 1984 to today. That's not helpful either, right? That no one's reading that and your value is getting lost in the details.
One of the tricks of this trade in preparing yourself, you know, like we were just talking about, no one has the attention span, right? So how do you make yourself succinct, concise, and not make it all about you at the same time. That's the balance. I think that's, you know, my best advice is to really think in that way. And if you have to stand in front of the mirror to do that, stand in front of the mirror as long as it takes and practice. It feels very uncomfortable when you first start doing that. As you kind of reflect and think about how you're coming across to people, that yes. really changes your lens.
I love that. You're so right. That how do you come across? How are you showing up? And sometimes you don't know, right? And that mirror can help you kind of hold up, because I had a virtual coffee about a month ago or so with a gentleman who in the beginning of the call told me from his career to the start to today, plus everything his kids and wife have done in their entire careers before he took a breath. And I was like, I don't even remember any of that. So here's the framework I usually take people through to think about that unique value. And there's two different ways you can think about it. So, you know, whatever feels most natural to you, because we don't want to be stilted. We don't want to be, you know, feel like this is a rehearsed, canned answer, you know, so think about this conversationally. But I am a whatever kind of executive you are who serves on the boards of these kinds of companies. So your target audience that are facing XYZ challenges, right? So that people clearly understand, okay, so you're a CEO or a CMO or general counsel or whatever, so legal expert, whatever you want to do, serving these kinds of companies that are facing these kinds of challenges. It makes it really, really clear. The other way I really like, I have a friend who serves a lot of PE companies as a consultant, but this works for boards as well, is XYZ kinds of companies bring me in when, and then listing the challenges that they're facing. From a governance perspective, if you're looking at boards. But this makes you easily referable because people clearly understand what you do. And then it opens the door for people to ask more questions. We're not trying to sell ourselves in the first 10 seconds of giving our entire history of the universe. We're inviting a conversation, to your point, to build that relationship.
That's a very easy to remember, easy to apply framework. So thank you for that. I think one of the things that we've spoken about also in the past is the art of active listening. I've worked in this industry. This is where I've seen issues. How does your company deal with that? And by actively listening to what they're struggling with, you can see very clearly where your skills, your experience may fit a nice framework that mm-hmm. they may or may not have. That's excellent intel when you're seeking to separate yourself as a candidate.
It is. You know, we say that that's a great way to show that you understand the point versus telling people that you understand the point. If you ask those thoughtful questions and then listen to the answers and then tie back your experience to what they said, that's a much more powerful way to explain your expertise. I often tell candidates who are interviewing for executive roles and board seats is that you can ask for the answers to the test ahead of time by saying, what are your biggest challenges right now? What is the company facing? What do you see happening in the next 18 months to 3 years? All of these things. Used to say 3 to 5 years, but that's dead now. But asking those questions and then speaking to those things is much more powerful than just assuming that you have all the answers to the test.
All right. So we've kind of teed this up, but maybe let's get a little deeper into it. So let's say your process has gained traction and, you know, what happens when you get to the point of you have an interview? What are the stumbling blocks that you see in the actual, whether it's the prep for the interview or the interview itself?
You know, there's two big areas I see board candidates make missteps in the interview process. One of them is forgetting to go high level enough from a board perspective versus coming in as an operator or leaning on their expertise as an executive who does things, right? So I know we touched on at the beginning of this call, but thinking about things like, you know, I'm an amazing team leader. I inspire others. I do these things. Like, that's not helpful in this context. So we need to think higher than that. How can you lead overall strategy? And if you haven't sat at the table, you need to think about board adjacent work, thinking about times, mm-hmm. you know, the executive leadership team, things you presented to the board, you understand what the board's asking for, ways that you can demonstrate understanding the point of governance and risk mitigation and things like that and oversight. So that's the one mistake I see, people getting too granular in the details and not high level enough. The other mistake I see is forgetting that board work is a group project. And you don't need to be the smartest person in the room, because you're going to be at the table with everyone else who is top of their game. And so no one wants to work with the smartest person in the room. And we need to remember that we need to be experts in our space, but we also need to be likable people that people want to work with. We had a candidate that we didn't work with, but he's well known where I live. And he reached out and he said, you know, I've got all this experience. I've got all this background. I've exited several companies. I'm a leader in this space and that space. And I can't get a board seat. And I don't know why no one would want me, because I could help them do X, Y, Z and blah, blah, blah. Well, his reputation precedes him as someone no one wants to work with from a board perspective. And so we need to remember that we need to be likable and easy to work with and also an expert in our space.
I'm going to ask maybe a pointed question about, you know, where do, I guess, let's call them overzealous board candidates, where do they tend to really make mistakes when not kind of digging deep into why is this company looking for a board candidate and where are the red flags that I may not have thought of in my desire to join a board?
This is such an important question, because board candidates can be so single focused on landing a board seat that you ignore the red flags in, is it the board you want to be on? You could have the opportunity to be on a board for 10 plus years, or in the case of my business partner, was the first board she was appointed to. She didn't ask questions and it was a lifetime appointment. You had to die or move. She moved. But we need to remember, like, is it a company you want to spend your time with? And is it a company you want to tie your professional reputation to? Because if you get in a situation where they're not maybe financially solvent, or they're not telling the full story to investors or whatever it may be, your reputation is tied to that. It's all fun and games until your name is in the paper, right? And so the things I tend to ask candidates to think about when you get into the interview process is, you know, asking the questions around, you know, what are the biggest challenges going on for the company? What do you see the role of the board? I suggest asking that question of several different people in different settings to make sure that there's alignment around the challenges, goals, and the role of the board. Because the other thing is, you don't want to get into a board with a toxic culture or just even a dysfunctional culture, right? So if there's big changes between how the CEO sees the role of the board versus the board chair, that's going to be an issue. The other things you want to ask for are, you know, digging into financial statements, things like that. You should be able to sign an NDA and look at these things. But if you don't get access to some of these things, or you're put off, or, oh, well, you know, you can absolutely see those things when we, you know, after we sign on, things like that, that's a red flag. If they're not going to be transparent with you as a potential board member, that is definitely something to consider.
I agree on that one. So we've covered a lot of ground here. Where do you think folks can think about other aspects? I mean, I know, for example, you know, we do a lot of board education through the Center for Corporate Governance. We also sponsor a lot of the many great organizations out there that cultivate networks of board members and provide continuing education and other opportunities. So I guess when you're thinking about all of this, a lot of folks ask about credentialing. What is the value proposition? I have my own thoughts, but I'd like to hear yours.
Yeah, no, this is a great question. And here's what I tell my candidates. And this question comes up a lot. Should I go get a certification from XYZ? Do I need a board certification to be qualified? The short answer is no. It is not a barrier to entry for board seats, and especially if you're looking at private company, and it doesn't make you automatically qualified to go get one of these board certifications. What it does do is two things. If you've never sat at the table, it gives you a good understanding of the vocabulary and the role of the board and from a governance perspective and what you need to be thinking about. And that can help you not only prepare for interviews, but prepare for when you do get a seat at the table, what it is you're supposed to be doing and what your mandate is. So that is helpful. If that's the reason for going through training or a certification, I wouldn't suggest a super expensive version, right? There's a lot of different groups out there that can do this. You probably don't need to spend top dollar. The other reason people may go and get a certification is because it comes with a network and it allows you to open doors that to maybe people and organizations that you wouldn't have gotten in front of otherwise, in which case it could be worth the investment. Again, if you're going to work that network and really do that thoughtfully, But then, you know, all the Ivy Leagues, certainly NACD, other organizations have strong programs that then come with a network. So I always tell people, you need to think about what it is you need. The thing I do suggest everyone do is get some base level understanding or certification or even a training session on cybersecurity and AI as it relates to the boardroom, because those pieces are critically important and can be a differentiator for you against candidates that don't have any understanding of that.
Very well said. I think everybody is a little bit different, and you really need to assess what are your underlying needs and how does this, if you're looking at an organization to help you do this, how will this organization benefit me either in the current or the longer term? That's an excellent way, I think, to think about that. And I mean, I think this is a really timely discussion. My phone rings every day with people, you know, just interested in learning more about what does it mean, you know, to be a board member. I'm looking at retiring. When should I start getting involved? And I think all your advice was spot on. And I really enjoyed talking to you, Deborah. So I want to thank you so much for our discussion today. I hope you'll come back, because I'm sure we'll have a lot of things to talk about in the not too near future. I do want to thank you. And I want to thank all of our participants for listening in today, and catch more episodes of BDO in the Boardroom. So thank you, Deborah.
Thank you so much. Anytime.
Thank you for listening to BDO in the Boardroom. If you like the show, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you have any questions about what we discussed today, reach out to us via BDO.com, where you can also access the resources cited in this episode and learn more about the BDO Center for Corporate Governance. The views expressed by our guests do not necessarily reflect the views of BDO.